The models were trained on cost so that, you know, people who cost the health system a lot would get referred to care in order to reduce those costs. And that makes sense unless you have the sense that cost and health are really different things. What it wound up doing was introducing bias so that people who were African Americans and others who tend to use less care but who are sick weren't getting referred for care.
From InterSystems, it's the Healthy Data Podcast. I'm Jordan Cooper. To learn more about this and other episodes, please visit podcast.healthydata.com.
We're here today with Dr. Cheryl Clark, the Executive Director and Senior Vice President of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers Institute for Health Equity Research, Evaluation, and Policy. Dr. Clark is also the Associate Chief of General Internal Medicine and Primary Care at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Jordan.
So by way of background for our listeners, the Institute supports emancipatory research, which aims to ensure that science benefits communities who bear the greatest human cost of longstanding health inequities. Working alongside 52 community health centers across Massachusetts, more than 1 million patients, they serve to construct a new base of research knowledge to better address health disparities. And today, Cheryl, the Institute's inaugural executive director, will be discussing the need for a data-driven approach to health equity in public health, emancipatory research, and widespread community collaboration to address health inequities. So let's get right into it. We're going to start with a conversation on techquity, which is defined as the strategic development and deployment of the technology in healthcare and health to achieve health equity, and is divided into four areas: workforce diversity, data trust, equity dashboards, and transparent AI. So Cheryl, I'd like to turn it on over to you. Please, what would you, what are you working on with tech equity? Why is it important? What is it? Where are we today?
Fantastic. Thank you so much for having me. And, you know, I would say I'm really excited for this conversation. I don't think that equity, I think it's more known, you know, now during the pandemic, everyone's starting to think a little bit more about fairness and bias in the way that we think about our data, but it's kind of an uncommon conversation. And so I'm really looking forward to saying next year. The other thing that I would say is I'm so excited to be here at the real beginning of doing with the Health Equity Institute. Part of why the Institute was established is to start to have these conversations which need to happen in interdisciplinary circles. And another sort of a bit of news, the Institute's work happens within what are called community health centers. As you mentioned, we're in Massachusetts working alongside 52 community health centers that are serving patients across the state of Massachusetts, sort of almost a million sort of folks who, in many cases, have low incomes. So 83% are at 200% of the poverty level or lower. And so it's really an opportunity to make sure that as we are thinking about what are the next steps for making sure that we close the gap along the lines of income, along the lines of race, ethnicity, other issues, how do we make sure that we're doing that work in partnership with people? So the community health center movement, which really had its genesis in civil rights movement, it was established in places like Mississippi and actually in Boston, not far from where I'm sitting today, in a neighborhood called Dorchester. Those were the two initial community health centers that were put in place in many ways to overcome segregation and to provide a place for people to get health care irrespective of their ability to pay. And now there are hundreds of community health centers in every state and country. And there's also an overarching body called the National Association of Community Health Centers. The exciting news is that the new director of NAC, the National Association of Community Health Centers, the CEO is a physician named Dr. Hugh Ree. And Dr. Ree has had a storied career, has worked in government, has worked in industry, with IBM, CVS, and is now the head of NAC. And he is the architect of And so,
So I know that you're working on emancipatory research and as it relates to structural racism. I was wondering, you know, I think many of our listeners have heard about this, but aren't exactly sure how germane it is to the operations in their large health systems. What are some of the issues that you've been working on to address?
Absolutely. I want to tell you a little bit about Tequity before, but I had to sort of give you that preamble to kind of give you, you know, a bit of understanding of where we're coming with this. But I do want to describe the idea of Tequity and let's talk about why that's related. You know, so the Tequity principles, and wanted to give complete and due credit to Q Rhee for sort of defining that. And there are really four principles. And I think this is where the conversation is uncommon. You know, as you think about sort of what you need to make sure that the data that we use to make decisions about health, all that needs to have at least a couple of things. So one is workforce diversity. You know, the idea behind that is that the work that we do needs to be multidisciplinary. You know, it needs to make sure that we have lots of perspectives. I will give you an example. There's a sort of a famous paper, and many folks who you know, are in the field may have heard about this, but there's a paper that came out in Science a couple years ago. And part of what we need to do in population health, where we're trying to make sure that people get the best care, that they get nursing when they need it, is that you have to build algorithms to try to figure out who needs that care. In a large sort of payer system, the models were trained on cost so that, you know, people who cost the health system a lot would get referred to care in order to reduce those costs. And that makes sense unless you have the sense that cost and health are really different things. What it wound up doing was introducing bias so that people who are African Americans and others who tend to use less care but who are sick weren't getting referred for care. And so part of what we need to do if we want to make Tequity, so equity in sort of technology, a reality, is making sure that we have plenty of expertise, that we get diverse perspectives, and that all that's a part of it. The other thing that I'll sort of I'll conclude before we start talking a little bit about emancipatory research is this idea of transparent AI. I want to make sure that folks have heard about a study. Just the preliminary information has been posted online that looks at large language models. And when the there's a collaboration between folks at UCSF and Harvard, stories, patient narratives, and worked with large language models to do that. There had already been so much training that a lot of the output had a lot of stereotypes, so that, for example, the majority of cases around a condition, a medical condition called sarcoid, it does tend to disproportionately affect, you know, African-American women, but all the cases were listed that way. So if we want to achieve Tequity, we really have to do a lot more, making sure that we work together. And that is why we need emancipatory research. The second question that you asked me is sort of, you know, what are we working on and how do we think about that? And, you know, part of what we mean when we say emancipatory research is two things. One is that, you know, we need to hold ourselves accountable for actually trying to solve these problems around inequity. And the second is that we need to create space and community for people who have that lived experience to come together with experts. We need to invest in communities and actually do the work where the implementation happens. And I'll give you one last piece around this just to kind of make it clear. A lot of health research does just describe, you know, differences between people. Part of what we talk about a lot is just the fact that women in the United States, and Black women in particular, I happen to identify as being African American, die, you know, at greater rates than other people, and that our babies are smaller and with health issues. I think the stats are like you know, three times the risk for African-American women than others, like a rate of like 69 per 100,000. But that doesn't mean a whole lot when it's you. And it was just me, and I tell the story. Sometimes it's just kind of cathartic just to kind of get it out there, but it also is instructive. In many ways, in addition to being a doc and SVP and all those titles, I'm also a mom, and both of my kids were born small. And we really, I got, great healthcare, great, attention to detail. And we just didn't have a lot to offer. I wound up being okay, and my kids are running around, so we're very lucky, but they were born early and small, and we don't really know why. So part of what we mean when we say emancipatory research is that we're taking this lived experience, my experience, the experience of folks who do have these outcomes, and we're trying to hold ourselves accountable for pushing the envelope, collecting the information that we need to try to understand these issues a bit better and to implement where they are.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing those examples. I think you covered a lot of interesting ground. I certainly was unaware of, I was unaware about the uncommon equity. Well, I want to talk actually about your particular example right now. You just mentioned that you gave birth to two to your children who were small. They were born early and they're small. I'm wondering if you're suggesting that the reason that they were born premature is because of your race. Is that what you were suggesting?
I don't think so. So that is what's really interesting about this, is that we know that women who are African American are at increased risk, right? And it's hard to figure out why that might be so. There are earlier data that actually look at women who, for example, are immigrants, who share the same sort of label, the same sort of ethnic label or whatever it is, and they don't have that issue. It's really women who've grown up and are in the United States. And so I think it's uncommon. And again, something that we're all getting more comfortable talking about, but there is something about the experience. We talk about structural racism, this idea that our societies are really are structured on inequity, and that there must be something there, but we have to go further. We have to push ourselves to try to understand what is it, what's going on. I'll be honest with you, as I had really well-meaning colleagues and friends while I was pregnant, discussing these issues with me, but I wanted solutions. As I was seeing my my older little one, the numbers just not looking as great, I wanted something to do. So I think that we need to have the data that helps us to think about prevention, but we also need a community to start thinking about what the solutions are, where we can actually implement those solutions, and that's what we mean when we say emancipatory research.
You mentioned something interesting when you were talking about workforce diversity, about how there's biases built into algorithms based on payer data. For example, African-Americans were sick and in need of care, but weren't getting it. Therefore, they weren't as expensive, and therefore were not getting the referrals they needed. I think that's an interesting example of biases correlated with race in algorithms. I was wondering if you can provide a concrete example of structural racism in large healthcare delivery systems, because many of our listeners are affiliated with large healthcare delivery systems and may be asking themselves right now, well, what can they do to improve equity in their own institutions?
Yeah. I have to say, and this is where we have to take a hard look at some of our practices. I am enjoying getting a lot more into the history of inequities and really thinking about the history of community health centers and how folks like Aaron Shirley, for example, a physician who worked with Robert Smith to found the community health center movement along with other physicians, and how much they really worked to put policies in place that ended segregation. The ways that we are noticing now that care gets segregated are really financial instruments. We have to have very difficult conversations about
prior approval processes. You know, what is it that we need to do to streamline this so that people, so that we give the kind of care that people need? We have to have really, you know, hard conversations about how we want to provide financial instruments for care. There are still 10 states that haven't expanded Medicaid. And so as we think about what this looks like, structural racism is a broad term, but it has really specific mechanisms. And a lot of them seem like really routine, everyday, you know, natural parts of society, but they have disproportionate impacts. So if we want to see just our neighbors, our friends, have the kind of healthcare that we need, we have to take a look at things that we think are normal and look at their impact and make those kinds of changes.
So I think many of our listeners listening to this episode right now may be familiar with the idea that indigency is inversely correlated with health on a population level. I think what may be worth delving further into is how to improve the health of minority populations who are indigent compared to Caucasian members of the population who are also indigent. So kind of controlling for socioeconomic status and trying to get at the structural racism that I believe is the focus of your research.
Yeah. That's really I think an important point. And what I would say is that that's also a part of what we think about when we talk about sort of emancipatory research, that we need to establish sort of high priority population so that when we think about people who have been traditionally disadvantaged, you know, how do we think about conducting research that's really centered on those priorities? Part of what I find interesting and exciting is the fact that we're now thinking a lot more about this term called social determinants of health or social drivers of health and learning how to connect and collect those data. I am excited about a project. It's been some years now that we did with community health centers that are affiliated with the Brigham and Women's Hospital. And my colleagues there helped to drive processes to try to do what's called screen. So asking patients questions about their social issues, so their housing, their transportation, and then creating a scope of work and referring people for services. And we did that as a part of the early phase of accountable care organization implementation through Medicaid in our state. And we're able to find that so many of our patients, and this was in a community health center that was really geared to serve high priority patients that have that do have low income, but 75% of them had some sort of social issue. And we were able to collect those data, and we've been able to sort of track over time how that is squared with healthcare utilization, preventive care. And so part of what we need to do is commit to collecting data, you know, at point of care that matters to people, and then putting services into place and building networks and connections. I will say two of the connections that I feel really excited about. We worked closely with an agency that has wraparound services for housing security to provide case management and to provide not just sort of housing referral, but also digging underneath and helping to support people to figure out what some of those barriers are to being able to increase their ability to access housing. And also we at our hospital have a system of care for people who are also victims of or survivors of intimate partners. So part of what I think what you're saying and what I would recommend is just have to really dig in to this idea of social determinants and social drivers and to do a lot more around implementing.
So I think, and by the way, for our listeners who aren't aware, I believe Cheryl was just referring to something called the All of Us Research Program on Social Determinants of Health Task Force, where there were 60,000 surveys that were completed to mapped, for example, the prevalence of obesity in America. And I think that's interesting insights, which you basically said that there's a variety of social determinants of health. I think I remember learning that health for an individual is composed of, is affected only, I think, by about 20% by getting access to health care. And the rest is affected by genetics, behavior, and social economic determinants of health. And I think focusing on those non-care related issues is what I hear you saying has been improving equity. I guess to wrap up this conversation, because we're approaching the end of this episode, I'd like to ask you a final question. So suppose that right now you're speaking to the chief information officer of a large healthcare delivery system. What sort of information, what sort of action is needed in order to address some of these socioeconomic drivers of health, particularly from the perspective of a healthcare delivery system? I know you mentioned ACOs, accountable care organizations, Medicaid managed care organizations, some risk sharing. You mentioned payers and providers meeting together. Where is there the financial incentive, and or perhaps where is there an action that can be taken by provider networks where that would be justified financially that could help address health equity and improve health outcomes for minority populations?
Absolutely. I would say if there were one action that health systems can take is to invest in the ways that we prioritize primary care, that we invest in making sure that people can access and get into care, and that while we have our patients and that we're doing this, that we also invest in systems to partner with organizations that can help us to address these broader concerns around social drivers or social determinants. It's been interesting to sort of see the field evolve so much. There's so many different ways of kind of getting data, using NLP, other strategies to sort of understand social determinants. But I would say that a really important way to invest is also just making sure that we connect with people, that we ask the kinds of questions that that are pertinent to our population. So hopefully, I think as this field evolves, we'll find the right balance, but making that commitment to addressing social drivers of care is really important.
Well, thank you, Cheryl, very much. For our listeners, this has been Dr. Cheryl Clark, the Executive Director and Senior VP of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers Institute for Health Equity, Research, Evaluation, and Policy. Cheryl, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
From InterSystems, this has been the Healthy Data Podcast. I'm Jordan Cooper. Thank you for listening.